Right, welcome back, everybody, to Couch to Couch, Making Therapy Make Sense with Chuck LeBlanc. Today we have a special guest, my supervisor and mentor, Garrett LaFosse. Garrett has been working as an individual, couple, and family therapist since the year 2000. He earned his master's degree at the University of Guelph Couple and Family Therapy Program. He is a registered psychotherapist with the CRPO, the College of Registered Psychotherapists of Ontario, as well as the CAMFT, the Registered Marriage and Family Therapist with the Canadian Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, and a professional member of the Canadian Counseling and Psychotherapy Association. Garrett has been teaching about psychotherapy in university master's level programs as well as postgraduate programs since 2007. Some of the subjects he has taught since then include human development, the use of self in therapy, family therapy, and couple therapy. Garrett is informed by a number of different therapeutic models and theories, including psychodynamic theory, systems theory, humanistic therapy, emotionally focused therapy, object relations therapy, Gottman model, existential therapy, imagotherapy, all of the good stuff that we have talked about on the podcast, because I'm quite taken by most of them. Garrett has worked in the mental health field in a number of different settings, including as a manager in a not-for-profit agency, as a group leader for intimate partner violence rehabilitation groups, at several family service agencies in children's mental health, and most recently in private practice. One of Garrett's interests is in providing clinical supervision to both new and experienced therapists. He started supervising and consulting with other psychotherapists in 2006, and became an approved supervisor through the CAMFT in 2009. He's a strong believer in the need for clinical consultation throughout one's career as a psychotherapist, and he finds conversations with other therapists to be enriching and meaningful, which I've experienced on a weekly basis for about a year now. So welcome to the show, Garrett.
Thank you.
It's always so funny to call it a show because it's a podcast. I don't know what the difference. It always ties me up, but whatever. All right, so I just wanted to invite you to say a couple of words to the audience if you want to let them know where they can find you and if you want to fill in any of the gaps that I might have missed in that introduction.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks so much for welcoming me. Much appreciated. And it's a real pleasure to be here for your audience. And if anybody is interested in finding out more about me, they can go to my website at www.garrettlafosse.com, or they can also find me on either Psychology Today or Therabive, which are a couple of websites I advertise on.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I'm excited to have you here. I know that throughout our supervision time, we've had a lot of lively discussions because we have similar philosophic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So I guess the first question I'm going to throw out there, which will lead us in, is kind of a big one. So why therapy in general? You have such an extensive background. So why did this field in particular pull you in? And then how did you end up dancing in all the different modalities that you ended up in?
So, you know, I think that the field picked me more than I picked it in some ways. I know that's sort of a silly cliche that sometimes people use, but it really is true for me. I was a person who had a lot of people just coming to me and, you know, pouring their hearts out about different things as a young person. I also found human behavior really fascinating. I lived in a pretty complex family dynamic in my family of origin, and had a dad who engaged in some pretty startling behaviors at times that I wanted to find answers to. So I thought about these things a lot and probably sometimes drove myself a little around the bend with it, but
fair enough.
Yeah. So then I eventually found my way to this as a mature student, and I discovered the University of Guelph's program in couple and family therapy, which what I liked about it was it looked not just at an individual, but at family systems and relationship systems, and how if I'm in a relationship with somebody, they influence me, I influence them, and there's a thing that happens between us that's very relevant, and it's very key to human existence, I think, as well. With respect to the question about the models, so I've explored a number of models, I've taught models, and I probably find myself most at home with the psychodynamic orientation. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a deeper kind of way of thinking about things. I don't say necessarily better, but deeper. And it's something that often takes more time. That said, you know, despite it having gotten a bit of bad press at times, and a lot of new therapies have kind of come in and been quite critical of it, I would also say that it's pretty deeply misunderstood too. Mm-hmm. So, and that's where I probably find myself most at home, but you know, existential therapy is something that I can just relate to as a human. And then some of the other ones, emotion focused therapy and the relationship oriented stuff. I love doing couple work, find it really intense and really demanding, but mm-hmm. lovely as well. So, and do a lot of it. So I guess that's a bit of an explanation for how I got there.
Yeah, fair enough. I know we've talked a lot about how the couples work intrigues me, but I haven't jumped in. I've trained a little bit in it, but I haven't really done it because it does seem so complex. And you were mentioning the family systems a minute ago and how, like, our relations will, in my understanding of it, our relations will help define who we are as much as the other person. So you kind of create and evolve our identities depending on who we are in relation with. And so when I'm thinking about sitting in a counseling session with three entities, right? So you have the both couples plus the relationship, and the relationship is the client. I find a hard time trying to mentally navigate how you separate all three to stay neutral in a way. That seems incredibly complicated because as the therapist, you're now involved in a relation with the three entities in the room.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And I, you know, I worried a lot more about neutrality, probably when I started working with couples. I don't worry about it as much now. I do, if I can say, on average, want to be projecting mostly neutrality. But there's also times when I need to take sides, whether it's the side of the relationship or the side of an individual person who is being dismissed or minimized or something else. So like, for example, I saw a couple yesterday afternoon and we were working on, you know, different things together. And each of them in turn, I challenged at different points in the therapy session. Mm-hmm. And each of them in turn, I really deeply empathized with, or at least tried to. I hope that they felt that that was happening for them. And, you know, I thought that the challenging needed to happen at different points, but mm-hmm. I also thought that the empathy needed to happen at the, and that the partner wasn't hearing the other person. So, mm-hmm. so I don't worry about neutrality too much because for me, if on average I'm empathizing with both people, challenging both people reasonably equally, that I think it all comes out in the wash, as they used to say.
Yeah, fair enough. And I guess it takes a lot of like mental energy to be able to do that. So it's amazing to think about and to hear the kind of the stories of the couples counseling. So I have a couple of other practitioner colleagues who deal with couples, and they always make fun of me because of how interested I am in it, but I won't jump in the pool quite yet. just because of how much mental energy it would take to hold space for that much.
Yeah, the interesting thing about it is, though, that the more that you do this, the more intuitive a lot of it becomes, you know? So I had to do a lot more thinking about what I was doing on the, you know, in a moment by moment way when I first started than I do now. Mm-hmm. Not that I never think about what I'm doing. I try to be often thoughtful about what I'm doing, but I also follow my intuition a lot in this work. And it doesn't always, it often does not feel mentally draining. By mm-hmm. the way, there are times when it does, and it's probably more times where I'm finding that people are at an impasse and they can't get past it, and they both feel hopeless, helpless. And I can start to feel that way too. and then to get myself and all of us out of that, and I can't always, but to do it sometimes can be a strain, and I have to dig deep sometimes. But, you know, it's interesting how just sort of finding a way to snap myself out of it works better than me trying to think my way out of it.
Yeah, fair enough. So, I guess that's the use of the body, right?
Yeah, the use of the body. And, you know, a thing I used to do a lot more when I was receiving a lot more supervision in the beginning of my career was I would think about what my supervisor and colleague might say. I'd be in a session and be thinking that. What would Jean or Andre say? And it often helped me just to do something, to snap out of it. So
yeah, it's amazing because it takes yourself out of it, which I guess is taking yourself out of your own patterns.
Like probably,
introducing another pattern.
Yeah, I think so.
So you don't get caught on the roller coaster of your own thought.
And what's interesting about that is that it's a bit of a parallel process, because the same thing is likely happening for the clients. They're stuck. They're not snapping out of something that they need to snap out of. They're not reflecting on what are we doing here that's not helping either of us right now.
Yeah, I'm interested about that, about the impasse problem. So when it comes to couples, how do impasses show up? Like when it's in the room, what's often the, I don't know if you want to say culprit, symptom, or how does that develop?
I think it's when, you know, my needs and my wife's needs, in my case, are in conflict with each other. So, you know, I really, you know, a silly example might be it's Sunday, it's my day off. I really need to rest today. And my wife really needs me to be at some function of hers for her career or some other thing. And both of those are really high needs, let's say, in that case, what's going to happen, right? And this is where people get into trouble. Where it gets even more intense is if both of them are engaging with their wounds. So their woundedness is part of the impasse, especially if it's older wounds that are longstanding, you know, old emotional injuries of theirs that have happened.
And so it's the competing wounds that are basically talking to each other.
Yeah, because I mean, you can imagine that if you and I, if somebody came up, let's hope it doesn't happen, and injured both of us right now in this moment, and then we were both required to give each other empathy, that would be awfully hard for us to do because we'd be too busy being overwhelmed by our own injuries. And in a way, that's kind of what it's like, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so I guess that what makes it more complicated is if we were wounding each other. If we wounded each other and now we have to talk to the wounds as the wound talking, or I guess this is where resentment shows up.
Yeah, I think so. And the other part of it is that if I have deeply wounded you, that can be pretty overwhelming for me, with respect to guilt. So since I don't want to feel that guilt, maybe I'll blame you instead. You know, you're too sensitive, Chuck. Why are you letting that bother you? I was only kidding, or, you know, or something that I might do to kind of minimize what's going on for you. But I might behind that be feeling like I've deeply hurt you. And those feelings might be very hard for me to cope with.
How complex is that? So how does that show up in therapy? Like, how do you handle that?
Well, you know, sometimes I will try to invite people to acknowledge the hurting that they've done of the other person. A lot of times they don't want to do that until I acknowledge their pain. So that's probably part of the process. And so I'll often maybe open it up with saying, you are obviously in a lot of pain right now. This is a very hard spot for you in your relationship. And spend a bit of time with that. And then at some point, I might ask them, you know, do you see any legitimacy in your partner's point of view? Is it possible that even though you didn't intend it, it still happened? And that's an interesting one, because people will be a lot more open to admitting something if it's identified that they weren't intending to injure someone. If it's being implied by their partner, and sometimes it is, that they intended it, that they meant to do it to them, that's often why people put their arms up and don't want to talk about it and shut down and try to shut the conversation down. But if I say to them, if I talk about the difference between my intent and outcome, I can mean one thing. I can go upstairs right now into the living room with my wife and children and intend one thing, and I may be hurtful or offensive or something, even though I don't intend it. And so when I help people to get their heads around that, and to feel that they're maybe, you know, this, it's not like they're like a bad person with evil intent or something like that, that we can introduce another way of thinking about it, which is simply that injuries happen even when I don't mean for them to. That often opens up more flexibility for people, I think.
Yeah, I guess brings the defenses down. And would you say it opens more empathy for what happened?
Almost immediately. Yeah. If I'm being told that I did something with evil intent, it's going to be really hard for me to empathize with your position, because you're attributing something to me that I don't feel good about. But if you say to me, I know you didn't intend it this, but this is what I felt anyway, that's a very different thing. That's an invitation to me, I think.
That makes sense. That has to be interesting to navigate in session, to watch people open up like that.
Yeah, and it doesn't always, you know, I wish I could, I wish it happened easily. It doesn't. It often doesn't. And I think it's because in large part, and it's understandable that people come in often in a defended way. They don't know me. They don't know what I'm going to do. They don't know if I'm going to judge them. And they may be thinking about things like the principal's office when they were a kid, if they ever went there, or something else. That's what it's going to be like. And if their spouse has threatened them, we'll see what the therapist says about that. And that sometimes happens too. They may be pretty antsy about coming in.
Yeah, worried about being judged. I guess that's a huge piece of the puzzle there. It's the same in the individual, right? In the individual, I mean, the first couple of sessions with an individual is all about setting up the environment so that they know they're not being judged. That's a huge piece of it.
It is, yeah. Joining, building a therapeutic alliance. Yeah, it's very important. And, you know, if you think about it, it's really not that weird. You know, when people tell you, I didn't like that doctor and I moved on, it's usually because the bedside manner wasn't good. And I would argue that it's essentially the same thing as what people feel about therapists, you know. Do they get empathy from us? Do they get that we care, that we see them? Or do they feel that we're sort of rushing them and lack empathy and are too mechanical or robotic or something else?
Yeah, it's the number one complaint I've heard from clients, friends, myself. Had everything to do with the how's the relationship going with the therapist? How welcoming was that relationship? Are they just telling me what to do? Are they dismissing me? Are they taking me seriously? Are they cold? Are they matching? Yeah. Are they in step with me, which is, I mean, that's the job. It's creating a space where people can feel comfortable to come out of their shell for their own sake, not for mine.
Yeah.
And it's something I repeat a lot in this podcast is, you know, give your therapist 2 sessions to see how the environment's going to jive. And if it doesn't work, get a new therapist and talk to your therapist about finding one. Because we have a network. We've known you for 2 days. Odds are we can find someone that fits better what you're looking for.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. And in so doing, when the therapist creates that kind of foundation, if you will, and it's not just the therapist that does it, but it's mostly the therapist's job. That often opens up space for what I might call rejected parts of people's selves, you know, things about themselves that they don't like, haven't accepted, have had rejected by other people, that they wish weren't there, but are, that kind of thing.
So it brings them out, you mean?
Yes.
I guess it makes it safe to bring that out.
Yes.
Walk me through that process, because this is relatively new for me. We've been talking about this for a couple of months in our supervision, but the parts work.
Yeah, so I'm not necessarily talking about parks work here. I guess what I'm talking about is that, I mean, let me give you an example. Someone might have a fantasy, like an angry fantasy of harming their spouse, and they would never want to admit it to somebody like me. And yet, understanding that fantasy and what's happening with it and accepting it non-judgmentally, and by the way, that's not condoning violence.
Yeah, of course.
It's a fantasy, right? So it's not something that they've acted on. But oftentimes when you hear that When you hear that and you invite that part, yeah, okay. So at that level, it's a part of the person's self. When you invite that part and there's a deep level of acceptance that they can feel, which then leads often to more authenticity and more honesty on their part about a whole lot of things. And that's just one sort of example of, you know, taboo parts of ourselves that we reject. I heard once of a man who went to therapy, and one of his in-law, either his father or mother-in-law, had passed quite recently. And he went to therapy to celebrate the death of this person and to talk about his great relief because they had been such a difficult person, a bane of his existence. He had no other safe place to do it. He wasn't going to go into his boss at work and say it. He wasn't going to tell his wife because she was going to be heartbroken and or angry or something else, and understandably defensive of her loved one. There weren't many safe places for him to talk, but in therapy it was. So all of a sudden, this largely otherwise rejected part of himself now has some space to express itself. And there was, by the sounds of it, great legitimacy in his relief. That might sound offensive to some people, but that is different parts of us. We do sometimes feel things like relief at the passing of a person.
I think that's so important because it's, you know, when we're talking about identity and the expression of ourselves, there are many different parts of us that come out. It's all one part, but we do spend a lot of time either resenting pieces of ourselves or you mentioned a taboo, or like trying to like put it in the attic because we're embarrassed about it, or trying to present pieces of ourselves to better fit in, blah, blah, blah. And I think that a lot of it is fragmented by core wounds or how we learn to grow up. If I think of the masks or personas we put on in different groups. But it's when you're able to express that in an environment that it's there for, then you can stitch it all back together. I think Lacan called it a quilting point in a story, where a lot of people don't realize that there's this multi-stories that we keep telling ourselves, and they're completely fragmented, and we're confused about it, and we don't know what to do about it. But there's always a quilting point that ties it together, which is you, and there's a purpose behind it. And oftentimes it's extended, from my understanding over being a therapist the past year and a half, it's extending from these core wounds that are playing out. We're defending ourselves from, running from, and they end up fragmenting these parts of us.
Yes. Yeah. And those rejected, I get it. I guess it is ultimately my contention that those rejected parts of ourselves, when they go underground, it almost always does harm to us and the relationships that we're in. So you can think, for example, if I have feelings of anger towards a person that I'm in constant interactions with, and I can't ever name that. And I'm not talking about smashing walls or acting inappropriately with the anger, but what about me just saying something like, I feel really angry that this happened. But when I reject that part of myself, it's not like the anger disappears or evaporates. It goes somewhere underground, and there's all kinds of things it might do. It might cause me physical harm. If you believe that, I do believe that tension holds in our bodies. It might cause it might lead to me doing things in that relationship that are almost, you know, passive aggressively harmful to the other person. Like I'm smiling as I'm sticking the dagger in, you know, kind of thing. And I might think I'm justified to do that because of the part of myself that feels angry. So I'm just giving a couple of examples of that.
Yeah, it really expresses itself through like guilt, shame, resentment, and then expressions of those pieces. I know that the physical embodiment of that, I know that all too well. You know, in my 20s, I had a relationship that was less than ideal. And so I spent most of my time angry, upset, and completely dismissed. But the way I handled it was to work more, do more school, grin and bear it, as I always said, never expressing it. And it showed up in issues with chest muscles, like anxiety in the chest muscles. I was hospitalized like several times, on medication several times, slept 3 hours a night. So it expressed itself through manic tendencies. because I would not acknowledge the fact that I was straight up pissed off and mistreated until years later. And years after, once I was able to acknowledge it, then the sleeping patterns returned to normal. The way I hold my anxiety returned to normal. It was an amazing unraveling of that chain.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, it reminds me of when I was, I grew up in Toronto, and I was in Toronto a couple of years after high school was over, and I happened to see a guy that I knew from high school. So we walked over to each other and just started chatting a little bit. Hey George, hey Garrett, you know, and at some point in the short conversation, he said, you seem so much less angry than you did in high school. And when I heard him say that, I it was interesting because what I had felt in high school a lot of the time was fear. But when he described me, he said I looked angry, and he stood a certain way, mimicking how I used to walk around and stand. And it looked like someone who was about to defend themselves from attack, which is interesting, you know? So I appeared angry, and perhaps I was, you know, cause I did have anger that I had to work through, but I felt, you know, the biggest manifestation of emotion I felt was fear. That's what I remember anyway.
It's amazing. You know, part of what I've found interesting about this journey myself, you know, with my philosophy background, is how in our society we cut things up. Like between, it's almost like the mind is separate from the body, or the body is separate from the mind, but we all know that it's one. It's just the language we use cuts it up.
Yes.
And I know in male mental health, that cutting up is just assumed. So I'll think like it's cognitive, or it's emotional, or it's physical, but it's all an expression of one body. So what I find neat about it is, you know, when you're in session with someone, or if I'm dealing with my own, I have many things I can pay attention to now instead of just my head.
Yeah.
Instead of just trying to wrestle with like the anxious thoughts, I can say, okay, well, what's my body doing right now?
Yeah.
Or yeah, how am I standing? Am I walking a little bit faster today? Am I sleeping a little bit longer? Like, what's going on there? And then it could always play back. And what I find neat about that, with what we were talking about, the core wounds situation, is that in healing, through, we can go at it from any direction, bottom up, top down, from the brain, but it's, so it's all one piece. And I think what really screws us up is when we dice them up. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and that's done very much in some of the gendered thinking that we have, and gender politics and what have you. And I, you know, if I had a dollar for every guy who came in and told me that he's logical and his wife is emotional, I'd probably have a new car every 6 months or something. But it's interesting. I think that's very valuable what you're doing there when you're working with men. And I try to do the same thing. And one of the ways that I think about working with men is very much that I'm one of them, or I'm one of us, you know, and that good old male socialization that often invites little boys to separate themselves from their feelings. I remember a story of my uncle. And he was about 5 years old, and he was, there was a pile of bricks that my grandfather and his brothers had piled because they'd taken a wall of a building down. And so my uncle was running on this pile of bricks. The men weren't paying attention to him. And at some point he fell and hurt himself. He hit his knee and hurt himself, and started crying. And apparently, from what I heard from my great uncle, my grandfather ran over and slapped him. You know, so this little boy is already in pain, and he's already quite distressed from what's happened, probably shocked, probably in physical pain from the injury. And he's probably embarrassed and other things. None of us loves to fall down in front of other people, or anywhere else for that matter. And then my grandfather comes along, and he adds something to it, which isn't helpful, you know? And that was the era, I get that. But I just think about what that sets up boys to become, you know, to separate themselves from that pain. Because apparently the little boy stood up and went like that quite instantly. And You can just see how that shapes us so deeply.
Yeah, that's an extreme ripple effect. Because one of the most common things with myself and then what I see in others is by denying the emotions, you're dismissing yourself, which is what, well, from what I've seen, the original wound is being dismissed. And so then you're doing
Yes.
it to yourself. So this is, you know, it's almost like dismissal becomes weaponized. I use that a lot with shame and guilt. It's the shame is like weaponized so that we use it against ourselves. You know, which reminds me of Foucault a bit, because he talks about in discipline in general is, you know, it starts with a regime, which is laws that people enforce on you. Don't do this. Don't lie. You're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to do that. But it's repeated so much that you then internalize it and do it to yourself. Both guilt and shame becomes weaponized so that you do it to yourself so that you can stay in society. And I'm using air quotes. And with men, it's the emotions are behind closed doors. And it's done so that we don't appear weak and we can fit in with the other men and not get stepped on. It's almost like we're in the jungle for some reason when we're really not.
Yeah, for sure. Sort of a Wild West situation. Yeah. 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 It's a hard one for people. I'll often speak of the metaphor of, you know, either our parents or a judgmental coach or teacher or somebody, you know, they treat us badly. And then we're 40 years old sitting in a therapy office, you know, talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then we discover with our therapist that an odd thing kind of happened. And I talk about the relay race, you know, when people are doing relay races. So one person's running, you know, we just had the Olympics in the summer. So there's a men's 400 meter.
Mm-hmm.
So one person runs 100 or 400, whatever the amount is, and then hands a baton after to the next person. And then they run with it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a way, that's what we can do as human beings, especially with these important people in our lives. You know, they gave us a message about ourselves that was deeply hurtful, but then don't we pick the baton up and run with it ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it becomes incredibly problematic because it becomes a part of your world. It's a part of your lens, you know, big boys don't cry. It's one of the fun things that we talk about. So then for myself, like I'm pretty in touch with my emotions. And when I see a man crying, my first reaction is that's weird. First, the gut physical reaction is
it's
almost like an oh shit, because I'm going to join in because I'm in touch enough to know that this is what this is for. We cry to bring in community because we heal together. That's the idea. And we need to release it because we're sad or frustrated or whatever the reason may be. And the first instinct is to isolate that person. They must be so embarrassed. Let's just leave them alone for now. When what they're looking for is to be acknowledged, you know, hand on the shoulder or something.
And what's key there is that you're taking a person who's distressed and you're coming in with more distress. You know, if you and I were walking along the street and a car accident happened and we went over to help and we found those people in the car in distress from the injuries that they'd experienced, we wouldn't go heaping more trouble on them at that moment.
That's right.
Like it wouldn't make any sense for us to do that. And yet a child comes into the living room with their parents at 7 or 8 years old crying. And sometimes, not always, and lots of times parents knock it out of the park in a good way, but sometimes parents say, go to your room or stop crying or whatever the words are. And that child internalizes that, but they're already in a distressed state and it only makes it worse. Now they don't just have to worry about their initial distress.
Mm-hmm.
Now they've got judgment from another person too, and rejection from another person.
Yeah. And then worry, right? Because, you know, my parents are angry with me for being hurt.
Yeah.
I was
and by the way,
comfort.
That child would never show those tears again because they want to be part of the pack. So the tears go underground. But then what does that do?
Mm-hmm.
And that's often the stuff of therapy. That's the stuff that we're talking to people about.
Yeah,
and again, there's that rejected part of the self, right?
Mm-hmm.
The child they pick up the baton, and every time they start to cry, even in a therapy session, they're in front of me and they're saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
Yeah. The sorry, that's so common. You want to hide it. You know, I know that when it happens with me, like in therapy, when I'm with a client, my job for male mental health, and this is entirely how I felt was right to do it, was to be 100% with people.
Yes.
So in stories of grief, which is something that I love working with, which I'm still surprised at, but it's something fulfilling. When someone is talking through a story of grief and they're crying, I'm crying as well. And in those moments, I understand what's happening. And so it's like free flowing because that's what I'm here for. Because my job is to show you what a vulnerable male looks like so you don't have to worry about hiding from it. But then outside of session, I still have the reflex of being like, nope. If I watch like a sad movie, it's like, hold on. And then I have to talk myself, no, it's okay, actually. I'm human, right? I'm allowed to do this. So it's amazing how ingrained these things become.
Yeah, I think it forms a kind of a body memory. You know, it's so knee-jerk to hide it. And yet, yeah, you're right. If I'm sitting in a therapeutic situation and I'm being intentional about it, then, you know, within the realm of therapy, when I have that hat on, I can cry. But, you know, when I was in the boys, when I was in the football locker room in high school and junior high, I couldn't, right? And boys were being extremely cruel to each other, whether they were, initiating each other or, you know, talking about the size of each other's body parts or some other kind of shaming, you know, homophobic slurs, you know, were common in those days in the 70s and 80s. So.
Yeah, it's amazing how this is just sparking something for me, so I haven't thought about it before. We're going to work on that together. It's amazing how many of these tactics, both from the outside and the inside, are designed to isolate. And it's push out of a crowd or get away from people. And then, as we know, depression, for instance, feeds off isolation. It wants you to be alone.
Yes.
And that, so it's amazing how this correlate. So then how do we work on that?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I sometimes work on it from another angle, which is to talk about what the shaming parent with the 7 or 8 year old in the living room was, what were they doing? And or what was driving that? And one of the things that I see over and over again in those sorts of situations where people often unintentionally shame others for their expression of emotion, it's that they're having trouble with what they're feeling when that person's crying.
That's right. That's right.
And you know, it's interesting to be a therapist because you see people cry a lot. You see people, in fact, I'm not just talking crying, I'm talking about primal sobs that are just racking a person's body. You know, you see that sometimes in therapy. And of course, you learn to accept it. Although, you know, it's interesting. I've done a lot of co-therapy over the years, and I can't tell you the number of times that I was with another therapist and a client just started to cry, and the other therapist grabbed the box of Kleenex and handed it to the person. And I remember when we were in training in my master's degree, one of us did that in a video with one of our clients, and our supervisor said, "Why do you think you did that?" And they said, "Well, I was trying to be, you know, caring and empathic and say, you know, here's a box of Kleenex." And you know what my supervisor said? "Is it possible that that could convey to the client unintentionally on your part, it's time to stop crying now?"
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So from then on, I have never picked up a box of Kleenex to hand it to people. Now, of course, now I do mostly virtual work, but when I was in offices with people, I'd have three boxes strategically set up in the room, but I never handed them to anybody because I wanted to convey the message that your tears are okay. And people will reach for that when they need to. So I don't have to be, you know, kind of polite and the good host or any of that stuff. I just need to be present with them, in my opinion. There are other opinions out there about this, of course.
Yeah, that's curious because I remember in my first couple of, like when I first became a therapist, which is nerve-wracking itself, right? You're reading about it,
Oh, yeah.
you're testing it out with your colleagues, but you haven't met anyone coming in specifically for that. And so when it happens, I was very like fast with the Kleenex, just like the flash, and all of a sudden there's a Kleenex like on your lap or right out. And in my head, I always thought, well, this is a reaching out.
Yes.
And one of the parts of therapy that I always felt uncomfortable about is like physical contact. And so some therapists will like hold your hand or shoulder or something. And that's just not, for me, that's uncomfortable. And so I felt like that was like the consoling motion. But now I'm questioning that a little bit based on what you just said because of how fast I did it.
Yeah. Well, and my opinion, for what it's worth on it, is that one can never know how it went for the client. I bet that for some people, when you did that, it was exactly what you described it as, which was a reaching out, a consoling moment. I do think, though, about when is it that people grab a Kleenex? Well, they usually grab it when they're done or close to done, and now it's wipe. So that, I guess that's part of the thinking as I deconstructed that when my supervisor said it. But I don't think it would always be wrong to be quick to pass it. But it might. What if it is once, and a person stogs it up and shoves it down? And some of our work together is about opening, not
That's
about
right.
closing.
That's right. So I guess you'd have to be very, it's causing me pause now because you have to be very open to the environment. And back then, like when I first started, I wasn't. My energies are like through the roof because you're like, I'm new. You don't want to screw this up, right? People are counting on you.
Yeah, new therapists so much want feel they need to feel like they're doing something, so like they'll say to me, what could I read that I can implement today,
That's
and
right.
that's what they want to know, right? And I get it, because I felt the same way. I you wanted to do something for sure. There is an art to not doing anything in therapy, to just reading the room and just sitting there using silence sometimes, when there's a pause, and not always pulling in all of those quiet moments.
Yeah, that was for me in my development. I think you and I have talked about this. That was the hardest for me to learn out of all of it, was how to be silent and how to be there for someone. That was a very difficult piece of the puzzle because I was so quick. I wanted to help so bad. And that makes sense. Find me any new therapist that didn't have that thought.
Yeah, of course. It's so normal, so natural.
But with the energy that I bring in, I'm always very energetic, no matter what we're doing. But trying to be silent and learning what that was all about was one of the most interesting lessons I learned in this entire interaction. Because it's so important to allow people to, well, silence is like an invitation, is the way it was described to me. Is you're allowing people to process and come to you when they need it in that exact moment. And you're giving yourself the gift to read the room and understand the environment and settle in because it's, as we talk about, it's a lot less cognitive than we think. And so part of settling in is getting your body used to the environment. What's happening here? How are you feeling about it? I mean, and that leads into what we talked about in the introduction with you is the use of the self as a therapist.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and you mentioned the cognitive part, and that a lot more of it is emotional than people give it credit for. I might even go a step further than that and say that if you look at the human brain and how it's evolved over time, the cerebral cortex, this big lumpy thing that we have in the front that's kind of like a globe, is the only thing that differentiates us from, animals that are more sort of primitively driven all the time. But what's interesting is it's the youngest part of the brain, of the human brain. So we have also been guided for much of our history, human beings, that is, as creatures, by the mid and hindbrain parts, which are very primitively driven. So it's interesting that we sort of in certainly in the Western world, maybe in other parts of the world too, I don't know as much about it, but we tend to treat the cognitive as though it's the gold standard, and therapy is no different. There's been As you would know, lots of therapeutic models that are very, very cognitively oriented that have come into the field. And perhaps there's an underestimation or an underappreciation of the emotional realm. And I'm saying for all of us, me too. You know, I just think about times when I've thought that I was at the helm of something in my life, and you know, afterwards, how absurd it was for me to think it. You know,
yeah, absolutely. You know, that comes up all the time, and I think that in part of my work coincides with my philosophy training. And there's a philosopher; his name is Maurice Merleau-Ponty, and his famous book is The Phenomenology of Perception. And his like addition to the game was that we are an embodied being, E-M-B-O-D-Y.
Yes.
Which meant we come into it body first. And that's everything. To separate the two is nonsense, because his theory implies that the environment that you enter affords you certain things. And your body picks up on what it affords you before your prefrontal cortex has digested what those things are. And my theory about emotions being a radar for which we understand the world around us, that's exactly where that comes from. So if I enter a room, let's say I have, let's say school is negative for me. So like growing up in my high school, like I almost failed it. And it was not interesting. It was boring. I thought I was an idiot. And so the thinking I was an idiot was a big part of my narrative when it came to school. Yeah. So when I first, I'll never forget the day when I first walked into university at St. Thomas, 21 years old, having my girlfriend at the time apply for all the courses because I didn't know what any of them meant. I remember sitting in the chair and being brought right back to high school as if I was, there was no time, as if 4 years hadn't passed. It was just the next day.
Wow.
And I can still remember my physical reactions to walking into that class. So I was nervous because it was new, that made sense, but I was also terrified. I was like, the minute that teacher opens his mouth, he's going to figure out I shouldn't be here. And that was just the feelings I was getting. Tightness in the chest, like hair on the back of the neck. I always describe it like there was a hook in my neck, someone's trying to pull me out of the situation. But those were all feelings and emotions first. And then my brain had to catch up. Why am I feeling this way? Oh, I must be an idiot. Like, what's happening here? And I still remember the relief I felt when the instructor opened his mouth and started talking, because that switched me out of, oh wait, I'm not in high school anymore.
Yeah.
This is different. But that environment afforded me anxiety walking into it because of the story I was telling myself, my experiences before, and how my body felt in high school.
Yep.
And we do this all of the time because that's how we are.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because there's this idea of the American dream, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And really this idea, you know, you'll hear Americans and others in the world too say things like, you know, you can be anything that you want to be. And yet, you know, there's so many other things that are determining what's happening. You know, it brings to mind, I'll sometimes talk to clients about a funny mechanism that happens for us. So if you imagine, if I just went out in front of my house here and there was a bus route, there isn't one, but let's say that there was, and I unthinkingly just sort of walk into the street without looking, and all of a sudden there's a bus coming along. Well, there's an interesting mechanism for us that saves us in those situations. And what happens is we just go bloop and we step back up onto the curb and get out of the way of the bus just in time. But what's interesting about it is that you don't have time for that even to go into your cerebral cortex. You don't have time to contemplate. You can't go, geez, you know, that bus seems like it's come pretty fast here. It may hit me, it may not. Maybe I'll be okay. I don't have any time for that. I just have to act. And thankfully, there are these primitive mechanisms in my brain that circumvent, they don't go to the cerebral cortex, they just go, get off there, and then and bang, I step out of the way. So, you know, a question that I have about that, you know, not just thinking about times when I'm in terrible danger, but how often is that kind of thing actually happening for me as a human being, where I'm not really thinking a lot about what's happening at all? You know, you've probably been aware of times when you've been driving your car. You know, it's embarrassing for any of us to admit to it, but you get to some place and you think, how did I get here? Like, I don't remember the last 5 minutes of the drive, but
Of
it's
course.
because it's so automatic that you don't, you have to even use up a whole lot of brain energy to do it. And how much of life is that? Is us just in habit, you know?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's amazing that we're able to do that. That's something I talk to clients about. And it's also my part of my obsession piece with philosophy is that it's this affordance, right? Because you also afford to the environment and how to treat you, right? So for instance, if I'm holding up this coffee cup, what's afforded to you is this side of the coffee cup. You can see it, you can see the colors, you can see the image, like all that stuff. What's afforded to me is the other side. But the coffee cup is separate from both of us. And it's doing its own thing, but what it's expressing, we're able to encounter it because it's there. But also because what are automatically paying attention to. So this cup is a Freudian sip cup, right? So it always makes me laugh and I always use it when dealing with psychology. But somebody who doesn't know what it is, they wouldn't be afforded the joke.
Yes.
But I am, so I always giggle about it, which is great. Because sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. But what I find amazing about the human experience is that part of these like amygdala responses, like these jolts, are habitually ingrained through practices over and over. And so sometimes it's about the stories we're telling ourselves, which we then engage into the practices, which help us flavor the environment. And sometimes it's just impressions we've got through emotional impressions that are repeated over time. So if you're constantly shamed when you're younger, then you're always going to assume that you'll be ashamed in relation. But it's not because you're thinking about it. It's your body's gearing up for it. This environment affords me shame. Or the body type that I have affords me shame.
Which I find it interesting. So it's a great example of that is when a partner is upset that their partner has betrayed them, has been unfaithful. And I will often hear the person who's done the betraying say, "Why can't you just trust me?" Or something like that. And the reason is because they can't, because there's another thing that's taken over and their brain has kicked into high gear and is protecting them from further injury. Now, of course, the danger for the person for whom their brain is protecting them from further injury is that it might actually be best for them to repair this relationship and remain in it. But the fight, flight, freeze response is so engaged that it's very difficult for them to turn it off.
Yeah, with good reason.
Yes,
it's amazing.
With very good reason.
And so, you know, part of the job is to figure out, you know, if I'm thinking, just going along those lines, a lot of it is trying to sort out where is this affordance coming from? So if you're ashamed a lot when you were a kid, then there's many ways to do this. One of my favorites that I've seen done is to walk back in time where you're, my therapist and I did this like two weeks ago, and it was one of the most amazing exercises I've ever engaged in, where we were able to say, okay, well, how are you feeling now? And so grab onto that feeling and then tell me, when was the last time that happened to you? And then we go back like 3 years later, and then we discuss the memory, we discuss what happened, all that stuff. And I said, okay, let's hop in our time machine and go back to the last time that that happened to you from that point on. And then we walk all the way back to childhood, and you describe the memory, you describe everything, feeling, what you were thinking, how you reacted, all of it. And then the question I got, which wasn't the question I was expecting, was, okay, so if you were there, what did that child need? So we know what they got, and we know what ripple effect that had. What did they need? And then the minute you're able to find that, which is either quick or it takes time because there's a lot of pain that you have to go through to sort that, we then walked back up the memory train to see what that effect would have had on this memory, and then this memory, and then this memory, and ultimately now. And it's amazing how such a subtle and empowering and sometimes painful trip down memory lane can lead to a different lens altogether of what you're going through right now.
Yes. Yeah, well, and let's go back to that 7-year-old kid that comes into the living room crying and then learns to shut that down their whole life. And then they're 40 now and they're in front of me in a therapy session. And I say to them, we know what you got. What did you need? When they start telling me what they needed, even the act of them telling me what they needed is one of these, sorry, folks, in the face of the idea of them having to shut themselves down. So if it takes for them, when they're talking about what they need, that rejected part of themselves, i.e. their emotions, their vulnerabilities, will be more welcome over time, interestingly. So, and by the way, that is a kind of trauma work. Anyone who says it's not and who puts a whole bunch of mystique around trauma work, I hear people say all the time, trauma, you got to be specialized. You can't, you know, not just anybody can work with trauma. Well, guess what? If you're a human being, not a therapist, you work with trauma. You may not work well with it, but it's there. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. A colleague sitting at the lunch table tells you something terrible that just happened to them or that happened to them when they were young. Whatever, you see an accident, you're in sports and you see an injury happen. We're all around trauma. Not all the time, but periodically it comes up. So whether we want it or not, it's going to find us in human experience.
Yeah, it's part of the human experience. Yeah. This trauma is just a way we protect ourselves. It's just extremely intense.
Yes.
Yeah, and I guess it all comes down to this concept of being dismissed and not, and how we unravel being seen and being heard and what that's like. Because if I think of that exercise and what you meant with the 7-year-old kid and then the 40-year-old who's able to like give the big fuck you to the moment he was dismissed, the next piece of the work, which I find to me is my favorite, is okay, now the emotions have a place and they're starting to come out of the basement. Now we have to understand, how do we understand their language? So how do you live now with emotions? Because it's new and it's not, you know, one of the common things that I encounter is that people think they're broken or there's a problem when it has nothing
to
do with
being... Why am I sad all the time?
That's right.
But it's nothing to do... all your whole life.
That's right. The dam has opened.
Yeah.
So it's I've never met anybody in therapy who is broken. I'll say that right away. Yeah. And so it's never about that. It's about, okay, well, you haven't used them.
Yeah.
So we need to learn a language. Yeah, that's right. That's it.
And you know what's interesting is that if you open a floodgate, because I think it's a great metaphor for this. So when you open a floodgate, there's an initial rush of water, right? Mm-hmm. Powerful, scary, get out of the way. But then it evens out. And then that's it just right. flows normally, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Once the water finds its level, then it just flows. It doesn't flow as powerfully as it did when you first opened it. And I think that that's what happens in therapy. And so part of what I'm doing for people is I'm just helping to support them through that process as that happens. You're very insightful to mention that part and the part it plays, because can you imagine if I'm that guy and I do this and the floodgates come and I'm crying all the time and it's scaring the dickens out of me? Well, what I'm going to want to shove it down again, aren't I? I mean, yeah. I'll have such a reflex to just do what I've always done.
Yeah, because the emotions wouldn't help. Well, that's right, because the emotions feel unsafe. Like the intensity itself feels unsafe.
Yes.
Like, and this is where the language comes from. Something's wrong. I'm broken. I have a problem.
And they were taught when they were little, your emotions are too big. They shouldn't be here. They're not okay. I can't handle them. Nobody can handle. They're too big to handle. So of course, when they feel big ones, what are they hearing? This is too big to handle naturally. But yeah. Thing is, as I said, with the floodgates, it will even out. It'll That's slow right. down.
Yeah. I have two things to say to that. One is that makes it so insidious when someone shuts down a kid's emotions, because it is about them, not the kid. It's almost never about the kid. It's
No,
about the person.
it's always about the adult, always.
Exactly. And I mean, our job as adults is to invite ourselves into the kid, not the other way around. The kid's not supposed to invite us in. We're supposed to go down and pay attention to them because they're fresh. These are all new.
For sure. Yeah, and they haven't mastered it yet. Hopefully the adult has, but as we were just talking about, lots haven't. But it reminds me of Circle of Security Group, an attachment-based parenting group. And one of the things that this group identifies is a child's need. And I think it would be fair to say that after air, food, water, clothing, shelter, and the basics that a person needs, probably the next most important need after all of that would be, help me manage my feelings. Help me learn to navigate the complexity of emotions, the intensity of emotions that I am bound to experience as a human being.
Yeah, and I think it's so damning when they don't, as we see every day, and I've experienced, like, it's interesting now if we talk about affordance. If you haven't dealt with your emotions or expressed them, then the environment is only affording you half of the human experience. That's it. Everything else is automatically dangerous because it's calling for those tears. In order to engage with it, it's calling for the joy, for the anger, right? Anger's a big one because the purpose of anger is boundary setting. And so if you're uncomfortable with anger was my thing. It was like very uncomfortable getting angry or when someone else was. But what was going on is I wasn't teaching people how to treat me because I wouldn't tell them. And so I didn't have an environment that afforded me fairness in any way because I was just the doormat. And so part of that was my own doing, part of that was the environment's doing. But I had no idea until I was in like early 30s. Basically. And then when you start to build it, the world opens up for you a little bit more. So I can imagine when all of the emotions are cut off, but, frustration or irritation, then the world's going to afford you a lot more to it. And if you're cutting that off from a kid when they're young, then no wonder the floodgates feel so intense. If we think of vulnerability, it's one of my favorite examples of that. When you're vulnerable, that's really where the power is. Because when you enter a room, you can get angry if you need it. You can invite people in for support if you need it when you're crying. The world is open.
Yeah, just to pick up on what you said about emotions, and I agree with this point that you're denying yourself a whole range of the human experience if you don't embrace your emotions. And I also even, it's interesting. I hear a lot of therapists use the phrasing negative emotions, and I don't even like that.
Yeah, I don't like that at
In
all.
part because when I do that, I'm talking about the ones you should never have, and yet what are you supposed to do when you have them? When you have disillusionment, disappointment, deep longing, disappointment, fear,
Loneliness.
agony, pardon me,
Loneliness.
loneliness. And by the way, none of us wants to feel lonely, but it's part of the human condition.
That's right. That's right.
And I have I would like to believe that I have a richer life because I feel lonely sometimes. I don't like the loneliness. I'm not going, yeah, over here, a batch of loneliness, please. But I recognize that it's part of the richness of being a human being. I don't always want it, but I'd be a fraud as a human being if I didn't ever have it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that, loneliness and isolation are incredibly painful. And there's a lot of defenses that go into them. But I think it also helps you to understand how much you don't want to be alone or what needs are here and to appreciate the time you're with other people. But
Yeah,
also,
it's
it's an
like
emotion
an alarm
itself.
system. Sorry.
Alarm system is where I was going with that.
Yeah, it's like an alarm system that is setting off. I think anger is too. I think we can learn lots from our emotions if we listen to them and try to figure out what is this about. But of course, If you're that 7-year-old and someone's shutting down your emotions, why would you be pursuing what they're about? Why would you be trying to make a discovery? You'd lose your curiosity. All you would think is, this is something to be shunned. I need rid of it.
That's right.
And yet you think about the wisdom that might be in those emotions, whatever they are, like loneliness. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm too disconnected. I need to feel more of a sense of love and belonging. Mm-hmm. What great information for me have.
Yeah, because it's an expression of that need, right? And so the reason we're isolating is an expression of that wound. It's amazing. People are, I like how you put that earlier. You know, part of the reason we teach our children how to express their emotions is because of how complex the human condition is, and they need to be ready for it. Not because it's scary, but because it's a lot.
Well, you know? And I would even say, by the way, I used to work in children's mental health for years, and I would explain emotional reactions to parents in this way. I would say, so have you ever seen a child when they're 2 or 3 years of age and they're in that phase where they get down on the floor and they're kicking and screaming and punching and having a tantrum? And then they get to maybe 4 or 5. And for most children, that ends. So I'll say to the parents, why do you think that is? What's the difference between 2 or 3 and being on the floor like that, and 4 and 5 and mostly not ever doing that anymore? Mm-hmm. And people will say, oh, I don't know. I don't have a clue. And what I say is, I would invite you to consider that it's that the child has learned mastery of a lot of the frustrations and things that they have experienced. So they are becoming more experienced. But then an interesting thing comes along where a child hits puberty. Mm-hmm. And guess what happens? They get to do the 2-year-old thing all over again, except that this time they may not be having tantrums, but they may have very deep emotions, perhaps thinking about their death, existential angst, other things like that. And the other part is that any injuries, emotional injuries that they have accumulated along the way in their life are now magnified. I don't know how much, but I always say to people, I bet it's 10 times or more, that those sex hormones that are coursing through that young person's body multiply the intensity of emotions and injuries that they've had throughout their lives. So guess what? They get to do it all over again. And don't so many 14 or 15 year old kids get into trying pot and alcohol? And part of it is because those emotions are so heavy. They're so difficult to navigate. And I'm talking about existentially for all of us. Nobody gets a free ride on this stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know if any of that fits for you, but that's one of the ways that I will talk about it sometimes with people.
Yeah, it makes sense. A lot, you know, with my clients, I make fun of when their kids are in the teenage years. I just say all bets are off at that point because the chemicals are going through their brain. So it's like the Wild West now. Yeah. And the best thing you can do is be with them.
Yes.
I like the expression of it similar to the 2-year-old, because the 2-year-olds are fresh. They've never been here. They've never felt it. They don't need to temper it. They need to experience it to understand what to do with it.
Yes.
In puberty, you understand what to do with it. Now the volume's turned up.
Yes.
And that is another stage, because in your life, although you'll never experience puberty twice, in your life you'll feel out of control emotions. It happens.
Yes. There's one other additional thing that's happening in puberty that isn't at age 2. And that's knowledge of your own death and the finiteness of life.
Yeah, the existential piece, I'm very interested in that, because that's so intense. It's so intense. And that, like,
and these young people
to work through that.
These young people, while all of that is happening, don't they also have the enormous task of identity development? I mean, you talk about, you know, I hear people all the time saying, and I in fact, I hear dad saying to their sons in hockey, because my son's in hockey, you've got such an easy life, you know, wait till you have some problems. And I kind of, like, I'm biting my tongue, but what I'm thinking is, actually, I would tell you that identity development's bigger than any problem you're facing right now, dad.
Yeah, that's right,
even
that's
if
right.
It's a terrible, you know, mortgage expense, or, you know, your parents are getting, you know, ill as they're aging or whatever it might be, man, that, I don't know that there's anything bigger than that task of identity development.
That's right. And I always say this to my younger cousins growing up, I'll always say, like, I would never want to do puberty again. It's because that's a mess. But it's a necessary mess. But it's a hard road, yeah. Wow. These conversations go in every direction, and I like that. That's awesome. Well, all right, so we're at the end of the hour here. So, Garrett, thanks so much for being on the show. This was a lot of fun. We'll have to have you on again because I feel like we could have covered so much more, as always. The next time, I'd love to talk about resentment. I think that was bubbling up a lot here, and I think that would be amazing because I'd be interested to talk about how that shows up in individuals, but then also, of course, couples and what that looks like. So we'll get you on the show again, but I want to give you the chance to just say your website again, invite people to reach out to you.
Sure. Yes. Thank you. So it's www.garrettlafosse.com. And people can also email me at lafosse@golden.net or even call my cell. I'm fine with that. 519-568-9917. Any of those ways to get in touch with me is just fine. And I check all of them pretty regularly.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks again for being on the
show.
Thanks
so much for having me, and thanks to your viewers.
You're welcome. All right, everybody. Thanks again for listening to the show. If you have any comments, you can reach me at couch.2.couch on Instagram. And you can reach out to the show, send me comments, all that good stuff. And we'll see you next time.